Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The eloquent memoir that Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin has just published reflects on two tragedies. His brilliant, incandescent 25-year-old son, Tommy, died by suicide on the last day of 2020. And a week later, Raskin and his family lived through the worst attack on the U.S. Capitol since the War of 1812. Raskin, a constitutional scholar elected to the House in 2016, takes us into his thinking and shows us how the pain of losing his only son nearly demolished him, and yet paradoxically strengthened him to plunge into a fight for democracy. Raskin led the effort to impeach former President Donald Trump a year ago, and now serves on the select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The book is titled Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. And Congressman Raskin joins us by Zoom. Welcome to On the Record.
Sheila, I'm delighted to be with you, and thanks for having me.
I am so sorry for the enormous loss of your son. And I feel that Tommy is the soul of this book. And I do want to ask you about him and what happened and why. But I'd like to start with your concerns about an ongoing assault on democracy. You give us a riveting insider's account of being in the Capitol on January 6th. You and other members could hear the mob battering the doors of the House chamber as you were hustled out of it, down passageways, through tunnels. And you write that you wondered at that moment whether the attack by the mob would go on for days.
Well, one of the things that everybody was concerned about in there was someone having gotten in with a gun. As Lindsey Graham said on that day, none of these people went through a metal detector, and they could have had a bomb. And there were bombs that had been left, of course, at the DNC and the RNC that morning. And so, what flashed through my mind was something that I think flashed through a lot of people's minds, which is how these mass crisis situations evolve, which is, you know, everybody starts yelling, screaming, there's pandemonium, there's chaos, people start calling their loved ones. And then someone shows up with a gun and begins shooting. We had a bunch of our colleagues who were caught up on the Democratic side in the gallery because of COVID-19. We were spaced three seats apart from each other on the floor. And so there wasn't enough room for everybody down there. And the Democrats basically crawled from their side of the gallery over to the Republican side of the gallery, and they ended up escaping from over on that side.
One thing you wrote shocked me. Let me read it. Quote, I had assumed that anyone who attempted anything so daring and transgressive as to commit violence against Capitol Police in order to breach, much less storm, the Capitol would be shot dead on sight. Close quote. Those last four words in italics. You are a great defender of civil rights. Is this what you think should have happened?
Well, you know, I haven't thought through that question, Sheila, about what should have happened about a violent attack and charge on the Capitol. Obviously, we want to use deadly force only as a last resort and only in response to deadly force. But I remembered real clearly when Tabitha, my daughter, and Hank, my son-in-law, decided to come with me on January 6th, they asked whether it would be safe. And I said, yeah, this is the Capitol. It'll be safe. And I had a very clear image in my mind from June the 2nd, when Black Lives Matter came to the Capitol and had a protest. And it was the day after Donald Trump and William Barr had unleashed a police riot, a paramilitary police riot against protesters, including a lot of my constituents in Lafayette Square. There weren't that many people there. It was, I think, just several hundred protesters. But I'll never forget seeing this huge phalanx of National Guardsmen armed on the steps of the Capitol. And up until January 6th, it had just been sacrosanct. I mean, I had never heard of anybody being able to enter the Capitol without a security clearance, without going through a metal detector. And the idea that there were 800 or 900 people who stormed the Capitol, who came in, without being checked. I mean, that was just unfathomable.
But that point about shoot on sight, shoot to kill on sight, is a lot different than your point a few pages later that you were astonished hours later to see rioters leaving the Capitol without being arrested.
Well, our forces, I mean, remember, 150 police officers on the Capitol Police Force, the Metropolitan Police Department. I can say proudly there were more than 50 from the Montgomery County Police Department who went down. There were lots of the neighboring jurisdictions sent cops. They were overwhelmed. They were bloodied. These rioters, these insurrectionists, were hitting our people over the head with steel pipes, with baseball bats, with hockey sticks. They were spraying cops in the face with bear mace, unknown toxic chemicals. It was an absolute bloodbath. Our officers were coming back with broken noses, broken jaws, broken necks, broken vertebrae, traumatic brain injuries that they're suffering from to this day. We have officers who are still in physical therapy and mental therapy because of what happened. So they were in no position to be taking prisoners. I can't even remember what the exact number of arrests were, but it was a tiny number compared to the hundreds or really likely thousands of crimes that were committed on that day, and not just trespass and violent destruction of property and assault on officers, but the other offenses working your way up the chain. And that's what the Department of Justice, according to Attorney General Garland, is trying to work out. But I think that there have been already more than 700 different indictments because of the mass and totally unprecedented violence waged against the Capitol. It was the most serious violence to hit the Capitol since the War of 1812 in the year 1814, and the most serious episode of domestic violence ever to hit the Capitol in Congress. Nothing like it ever happened during the Civil War.
That's Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin on the record on WIPR. He represents Maryland's 8th District, which stretches from Tacoma Park to the Pennsylvania line. We're talking about his memoir, Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. So even while the insurrection was continuing, while you and other House members were in hiding, you say you were focused on getting back to the chamber to finish counting electoral votes.
Well, my first thought was to get to Tabitha and Hank and to get them evacuated because they were stuck in Steny Hoyer's office with my chief of staff. And they had locked the door. They'd barricaded themselves in. They were hiding under the desk and the mob was pounding at the door. Finally, when the National Guard came in and reinforcements arrived, they were able to secure the House chamber. You know that one of the rioters was shot and killed, Ashley Babbitt. And that's ultimately what drove them back from completely overrunning the House side the way they overran the Senate. And, you know, you saw the QAnon shaman and other insurrectionists taking over the Senate of the United States. Again, another completely unbelievable scene. But the Tabitha and Hank were rescued by our officers. And, you know, I am somebody who will tell you that those police officers saved our lives, and progressive people and liberal people need to be on the side of the police and law enforcement. I am on the side of the cops, just like I'm on the side of the firefighters and teachers and other public servants. And all of those phony right-wingers who show up only to defend, you know, one or two racist cops who kill somebody are not pro-law enforcement if they stand by and let this happen. And that's what they're doing. And we don't hear a peep from any of them about these violent assaults on our officers.
You take readers inside the 2021 impeachment, the planning, the decisions, and you write that you thought it was more likely you would get 76 votes or even 100 rather than the 67 votes it would take to convict the former president. Why?
Well, 100 votes because all of the evidence was on our side and it was completely unrefuted and irrefutable, I think. Trump's lawyers didn't even really try to contradict anything we were saying. They never even challenged the idea that a president who incites a violent insurrection against the government is subject to impeachment. They made some noises about the First Amendment, which we completely demolished. And the evidence was totally on our side. So I thought that this was an opportunity for the Republican Party finally to exorcise the demons of Donald Trump. And remember, most of these Republicans had had serious problems with Trump when they all ran against each other in 2016. So I thought this was their moment when they could remember when they reviled Donald Trump instead of bowed down to him like some kind of religious cult leader. But they didn't do it. I thought 76 was more likely, far more likely than 67, because 76 is 50 Democrats. And we thought that we would get all of the Democrats because they would come to it with a juror's mind, actually looking at the evidence. And that would represent 26 or a majority of the Republican caucus, because there are 50 Republicans in the Senate. And I thought McConnell will only go with us if he's got a majority of Republicans on his side, because otherwise Trump, of course, will exact retaliation by running somebody against him and supporting that person against him. So McConnell only would have felt comfortable actually voting against Trump, although I'm convinced that McConnell was convinced that Trump was guilty of sin, but he only would vote against him if he thought he had a majority in the bag.
Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate. In the end, you got 57 votes, 10 shy of what you needed to convict. Was the impeachment worth doing?
Absolutely. I mean, we, first of all, got the most sweeping bipartisan result in a presidential impeachment trial in the Senate in U.S. history. We got every single Democrat, and we got 7 Republicans, which is 14% of the Republican caucus. We had Republicans from New England, from the Mid-Atlantic, from the South, from the Midwest, from the Southwest, from Alaska, from all over the country. And we created a definitive historical record. We convicted Donald Trump in the court of public opinion, and we convicted him in the eyes of history. And we set the groundwork for everything that the Select Committee on January 6th is going to be able to find and to release to the public in a report and ventilate through public hearings.
We need to take a short break on the record. When we're back with Congressman Raskin, we'll talk about his son, Tommy. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. In his memoir, Unthinkable, Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy, Congressman Jamie Raskin paints a picture of his son as brilliant, talented, funny, thoughtful, a poet, an intellectual, a stand-up comedian, even as he was gripped by depression and anxiety. Congressman, you write that at one point Tommy told you that he didn't think he would ever be happy. How did you deal with that?
Well, that was a brutal conversation. I immediately told Tommy that when you're sick, it's hard to imagine being healthy again. And when you're healthy, it's hard to imagine being sick. And when you're happy, it's hard to imagine being sad. And when you're sad, it's hard to imagine being happy. And so this too would pass. He would get through it. That did not seem to move him very much. And I talked about the ways in which we can do things to make ourselves feel better. And Tommy, of course, had a doctor and was medicated, but it was a sobering conversation that day. I remember it really clearly. And I wish instead of trying to talk him out of it or talk him through it, I had instead raised the subject of suicide and just asked him how he was feeling and what he was thinking about. And I'll just have to live with that because I condemn myself for that.
But he had such talent and ability. Tell us about him.
Well, he had just boundless talent and, more importantly, love for the world and love for his friends and love for his family. He was brilliant. He was in his second year at Harvard Law School. And he didn't like the way law school was set up with the Socratic method about particular cases and kind of hiding the ball and trying to get students to guess it, what the law is, instead of just teaching people comprehensively about the law, how it had evolved historically and what the rules were and what are the options for state legislatures and for Congress and for judges. And he thought that they were making a really big deal out of law school with this whole Socratic method, and that there should just be a much more straightforward elucidation of what the law is. And so he began to read these huge treatises that set forth the law. And he found that clarifying and demystifying. And, you know, he was somebody who loved magic and did magic tricks, but he didn't like magic and obfuscation for the purposes of confusing people.
I love that as a kid, instead of a bedtime story, he'd say to you, tell us a case, a Supreme Court case.
We had a friend who lived with us who was clerking on the Supreme Court, who's now a federal judge. And she tells the story of how she took Tommy down to Justice Stevens's chambers where she was clerking. And she was bragging about how much she loved Justice Stevens on the way down. And then Tommy said, well, what about his dissenting opinion in Texas versus Johnson, which is the flag desecration case? And Tommy was, I think, 7 years old. Maybe he was 8 years old at the time. And she was somewhat taken aback. But Tommy was talking about how Justice Scalia really had it right in that case, where he was saying that, you know, it's an aspect of people's freedom of expression. So Allie began to defend Justice Stevens, saying, well, in his opinion, he writes about how desecrating a flag is like painting graffiti on the Lincoln Memorial. And Tommy said, well, yeah, but we only have one Lincoln Memorial, but everybody can have their own flag, and that's their private property. Why can't they do with it what they want? So he was just enormously precocious in terms of thinking about law and philosophy and logic. But those who knew him will tell you that his intelligence was not the thing. It was his heart. It was his love of humanity, his love of animals. You know, he was a passionate vegan. And he recruited tons of people, including in our family, to not eat animals. And he just said, look, he loved the taste of meat like everybody else. He wasn't like a guilt-tripping vegan kind of person. He just said, in the age of, you know, Beyond Sausage and Impossible Burgers, there's no reason for anybody to be depending on the slaughter of animals for their protein anymore.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jamie Raskin, who represents Maryland's 8th District in Congress. We're talking about his memoir, Unthinkable, and about his son Tommy's death by suicide, the January 6th insurrection, and subsequent impeachment of Donald Trump. Early in the book, you write that you continue to, quote, arraign and prosecute, close quote, yourself for every clue you missed about Tommy's plan. But it seems to me that you and Sarah, your wife, were very attentive. What else do you think could have been done?
Well, one of the things I talk about, Sheila, in the book is that I fault myself for is not using the word suicide freely and censoring myself about that on the fallacious assumption that to utter the word is to invest it with power. And that's just a stupid superstition. And the truth is quite the contrary. If you don't talk about something, it invests it with mystery and power. It's like not talking to a high school kid about sex. I mean, do you think it's not going to come up? Do you think they're not going to think about it? And so we have to talk to everybody, but we have to talk certainly to depressed people about suicide and have very open channels of discourse, not just about how are you doing and how are you feeling, but have you been having thoughts of self-harm? Have you been thinking about suicide? And I just fault myself for that. And I liken it to my self-censorship about the word fascism, not using the word fascism in American life, because we do believe and hope for American exceptionalism, that we are not subject to those kinds of historical forces, but that's just stupid. And we saw what happened on January 6th. And so anyway, those are two words that I will speak a lot more in my life. And I don't know. People have sent me different messages about that who've already read the book. One woman wrote me a nice note saying that, you know, she dealt with a family member who talked about suicide, and she talked about it freely, and that they still lost her. And so she was trying to warn me away from the idea that this is some kind of panacea. But in any event, I do think we need to talk about it, and we need to let people know that there are lots of resources out there, and that suicide's a permanent thing, and our feelings change and our health changes. And I'm not trying to understate the gravity of what people go through, because I've never been depressed, but I can understand that people have a feeling of absolute entrapment and desperation. And that's where it comes from. I'm not judging them. I'm not castigating them. I'm not trying to create stigma around it, but I just want people to know that we should create maximum possibilities for people to talk about it.
Tommy left a note that you and Sarah read often. What does it say?
Well, it's the last thing we see every night before we go to bed, and it's the first thing that we look at in the morning. And he said, please forgive me my illness one today. Look after each other, the animals, and the global poor for me. All my love, Tommy. And, you know, when I see those words, all my love, I know that he gave all of his love in everything that he did. And I think by asking us for forgiveness, he authorizes us to ask forgiveness from him for whatever mistakes we made.
And you say that note now sets your agenda.
Yeah. It's like a roadmap for the future.
You write about visiting family in Florida last winter, quote, because I wanted to find out whether I could laugh again and whether it would be all right to do that, close quote. Do you have an answer?
Well, one of the miseries of this process is that Tommy was like the funniest person you could ever imagine. He was an absolute riot in the old-fashioned sense of the word. He loved comedy. He loved humor. He loved funny movies. You know, in our family vacations and reunions and stuff, we would always have a stand-up comedy competition in the family. And the kids would get up, and some of the grown-ups would get up, but Tommy would always win it. And he wrote plays, and he wrote poetry, most of which was more serious. But so one of the weird things about this is that I identify him with laughter and with comedy and funniness. And yet the experience of losing him is so bound up, of course, in sadness and tragedy and grief. But I want people to remember who he really was. I mean, he was a really funny guy. So I hope we are recovering our laughter, and it's with Tommy and through Tommy that we will.
I am so grateful for this conversation. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Sheila, and thank you for reading my book. It means a lot to me.
Jamie Raskin, a Democrat who represents Maryland's 8th Congressional District, has just published a memoir titled Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. If you know someone who may be thinking of harming themselves, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. I'm Sheila Cass. So glad you're with us on The Record. Come back tomorrow.